This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
In the 17 years that we've been doing The God Show, this is the first time that I will ever have been able to say about a guest that we're about to introduce. He's a kid from the streets of Topeka, Kansas. Chris, I mean, that just doesn't sound like a tough place to be brought up. Chris Martin is our guest on The God Show, and you'll find out a great deal about him and his one life. One Life is the title of the book. So, Chris, welcome to The God Show. Talk to us about the mean streets of Topeka.
Thanks for having me, Pat. I appreciate it.
You bet.
I was thrown onto the mean streets of Topeka. I didn't really think they were that mean growing up as a young kid. Your normal boy, family life, kid brothers and sisters. But as I went through an abusive relationship with my family, my parents, my mother in specific, I began running away.
And why?
From the abuse. The abuse was pretty rough in my family. My mom had a drinking and drug problem. I'm not real sure what the abuse came from or why.
What about your father?
My dad wasn't in the picture. I met him when I was 28 years old, much later in life. So I really didn't have a lot of places to turn. And when the abuse started to happen, the only thing I knew to do was run away. So that's how I came to be on the streets in Topeka and learn pretty quickly how rough they really were. The gangs were pretty bad back home. No one thinks of the gang life being very big in Kansas, but if you think about Kansas being centrally located in the United States, everything passes through Kansas, whether it be drugs or money or anything else. Everything seems to pass through that area and settle.
I keep thinking that gang fights in Kansas would be a group of people whipping one another with wheat stalks.
Yeah, not anymore. They actually figured out what weapons are nowadays. And the gangs got pretty bad back in the 90s when I was in high school there. It seems to have gotten a little bit better since when I was there. I'm hoping that's the truth. When I was there filming for the documentary that we're shooting, there were still some reservations from the schools that I went to about allowing us on to film just because of the threat of violence and the threat of retaliation.
Now, the documentary that you mentioned, I'd like to go back to it right away because not too many people in our worldwide audience can say, so I have this documentary being made about my life, and it is a documentary that follows the course of the book that you've written, One Life.
Absolutely. Yeah, I felt like, and you can always get into pretty good detail with the book, but if it gets too long, then you fall asleep or you lose interest in the book. And I felt like I couldn't get enough into the book and tell all of the story that I wanted to and really touch home. I felt like the motivation that I'm trying to really put out there, I just felt like it could hit all markets and all demographics with the show and the book.
So are your first memories now, I don't usually ask a guest this, but I think that it puts things into perspective if you tell us how old you are now.
Yeah. I'm 43. I'll be 44 in April.
All right. So that many years ago in your childhood, your first memories, those were memories of abuse? Those were memories of loneliness?
Yeah, no, my first memories I really remember of anything about being at home was violent. It was drinking. It was things being broken. I don't remember much before about 8 or 9.
Is there physical abuse, psychological abuse, both?
All of the above, absolutely. My mom was a drinker, very young when she had me, 19 years old. And she was the type of woman I believe was abused by her family or her dad or someone in the family, because it seemed that every relationship after that, if the gentleman didn't put his hands on her, she didn't want to be around.
And there were many gentlemen?
Yeah, I'm the oldest of 8, and I believe there were 5 stepfathers between the 8 of us.
So growing up then in Topeka, Kansas, gang life, the mean streets that were mean, but maybe not necessarily as mean as your mom.
No, honestly, I was willing to take the risk and run that chance of fending for myself versus knowing what the end result was going to be at my house.
Did you know how other people were being raised that weren't being raised in that environment?
You know, not at that time, I didn't know, other than as I got a little bit older in junior high and had friends and, you know, would speak about home life and actually had my first girlfriend at the time. She was the one who really told me, you know, that's not how it's supposed to be.
Well, would you go visit them? Would you see what the environment was that was so dramatically different?
You know, once I was old enough to be able to do that, I did. I would visit her, Linda, and her family, and just I met her mom, and everyone was just so nice and welcoming and complete polar opposites of what my family was like. I tried to bring Linda home to meet my mom, and it was the worst, most embarrassing scenario ever.
Tell me about it.
We were walking home from football practice. I was late already from practice. I was a diehard. I loved my sport, but I also didn't want to go home. I was in no hurry to go home and see what was happening. So Linda would often offer to walk me and say, you know, I have your side and your back and I'll help you. And we'd get close. And the one day that my mom came out, I was excited. I was like, my girlfriend's going to meet my mom and this will be neat. And before I even made it to the front porch, my mother was mad that I was late and obviously already drunk. Before I made it to the porch, she'd called Linda every name from whore to slut. And I honestly looked over my shoulder wanting to apologize, but I wanted to distract my mom and make her quit, you know, giving Linda a hard time. So Linda just turned and walked away. And once I made it up on the front porch, my third or fourth stepdad, whatever, came out on the porch and hit me in the face with a chair, broke my teeth and broke my nose. And Linda got the point real quick that, you know, my family's not welcoming of strangers or girlfriends or even us. They don't like us at all.
Did it change her feelings about you?
Not at all. She actually got closer. She felt like she wanted to support and help and be there in any way she could. But I also think it made her afraid. It made her a lot more afraid because she didn't understand that life at all or really what do I bring to the table when I come from a lifestyle like that, you know? The big fear is, am I going to hit people too? Am I going to cause violence like that in other people's lives? So I can only imagine what was going through her head as a young girl.
Were all those stepfathers cruel to you?
You know, from what I remember, no. My first stepdad was a really good guy. He was just tired of dealing with my mom and the violence, and then they became violent with each other. He didn't really get violent with me until after the fact, after their divorce. And he was a painter. He would paint houses. So lacquering and painting and then drinking a lot, you come home, you're not the same person. Because I had the issues with mom that I did, it caused issues with him, which was just a really, we both were kind of in the middle of my mother. You know, my stepdad was in the middle of me and her because of the games that she would play with us and then vice versa. It was just really a twisted story. So as far as the stepdads go, I think they just kind of put up with me because of mom. But the only one that was really, really violent was Mike, the father of my two siblings, Michael and Geely. And he was really violent. He was the guy that was supposed to come save mom from all the other stepdads. And then he was the worst. He was the one that when he died of colon cancer, I wasn't sad.
Name one male that was a positive influence on your life in those days.
Man. I'd have to go with...
A dramatic pause.
Yeah.
Long period of thought.
A male role model positive in my childhood.
A teacher, a coach.
You know, in those days, it would have to have been probably a coach, like... Coach Ken from football in high school. You know, as I got older, men started to play a little bit more of an important role. But as a kid, my male role models were on the TV. If they were
like who?
Honestly, growing up, I was a diehard football guy. So my team at the time was the Chiefs. So anyone on the Chiefs team as a male that played football was a role model to me.
Name one.
Oh, man, Christian Okoye, the Nigerian Nightmare, was one of my most favorites. Daron Cherry on defense, Wilson, and then baseball, you know, George Brett, anyone on the Royals. I was a very devout, devoted, loyal patron of my teams.
You know, the Chiefs and the Royals both would like to have some of those guys back.
Absolutely.
No matter how well they're doing now,
right,
they could always use that kind of help.
Absolutely.
And you know what is remarkable to me? After the cruelty, after the nightmares, after the kinds of things that we want no child to ever experience. In sports, you found an escape. And you remember the names of the guys when you were in high school.
I do.
And you're a 40-plus-year-old man now.
It was a very important time to me. I felt like when I was on the field, nobody in school or nobody on the faculty, nobody knew that I was in a group home. Nobody knew that my mom hit me. Nobody knew that I had issues at home because I could throw a ball 60 yards. I could score 4 touchdowns in a game. I guess I utilized that to my advantage. I really took advantage of that talent to the best of my ability to survive that time period. At the time, I felt like I was just playing a game. I was just working out and doing what I was doing. But obviously, 30 years later, it was my way of survival.
You're talking about throwing the ball. Were you a quarterback?
I was.
Okay, but every once in a while, you got a chance to hit a guy.
I did.
Was that okay?
It was okay. It was really okay. I was probably one of the only 6A quarterbacks that also played defense, played both ways, for that aggression purpose alone.
What was the best thing you remember about growing up?
You know, the best thing I think that I remember about growing up was the fact that nobody knew how I grew up. I could walk through 8 high schools no matter how many times I had been replaced in a new placement, and I got a new start. For me, you know, I would probably think that it would be a down that you get moved that much, but on my, you know, from my vantage point, I got to pretend. I got to start my new life or my one story all over again and not have to tell anyone, like, yeah, I'm from a group home or my mom punched me in the face, or I didn't have to tell anyone. I could really come out with whatever story I really wanted. And not that I told stories, but I really could sugarcoat it a little bit. And, you know, if I'm the new guy in town, everyone's curious anyway.
But was it the same town? Weren't you in Topeka most of that time? Why were you moving around in a small, relatively small, yeah, Midwestern city?
Well, I think everyone knows that the systems, no matter how big or small the city you're in, they're all broken. These systems aren't meant to house a bunch of kids in need of care. It's really meant for people who break the law and then funnel this through this system into prison. As a kid, I didn't even receive my first foster home until I was 17. So I had been in the system from 9 years old to 17 without a foster home. Once I finally received those foster homes, I was such an angry boy, almost a man. I didn't want any part of it. I was more about how can I sneak out the window and steal the car or not be here. I just don't want to be here anymore, because at that point you realize nobody wants you. You know, most people in foster homes that run foster homes, they want babies. They want a new baby that isn't someone else's old headache. And at 14, I'm someone else's headache. I'm somebody else's problem at that point. So it's easier to throw you in a group home. Well, not there aren't group home bed spaces available always in the town that you live in. So if that means you get shipped 3 hours away to fill a bed space, then by all means, that's what happened.
Were you most angry at your mom or society or the system?
I'm still not mad at my mom.
Why?
She's my mom.
Yeah, but you know, that whole business about how thick blood runs, and when it's family, all is forgiven. That's kind of hard to do.
You only have one, though, and you can't pick and choose. I think if we could pick and choose, we would. I think that'd be the first thing we'd do, is everyone would have June and Ward Cleaver as their parents, and we'd move on. But that's not realistic. And honestly, if I didn't have the mom I had, I wouldn't be sitting here today. I wouldn't have a book or a documentary or a family that I'm proud of.
Where would you be?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know. I don't know where I would be. Had I not walked what I walked and maybe jumped into the situation and not had the help or CASA or the people backing me, I probably wouldn't be alive. I mean, to be honest, you know, it is Topeka, but I went to 8 funerals my senior year from gang shootings, from drug deals gone bad.
In Topeka, Kansas.
Absolutely. They just did a show called 60 Days In on A&E, and it's about Topeka, Kansas. It's about one of my old high schools, Highland Park, where they send adults in dressed up as kids to try to find out what's going on in high school, the drugs and the bullying and everything. And they did it on Highland Park High School, which is one of the biggest schools of gang violence and drugs. And it's in the middle of the Deer Valley Projects in Topeka.
We're talking to Chris, the pride of Highland Park, Topeka, Kansas. Chris Martin's story is written about in a book called One Life, and the film process is going on right now. It's still being shot, right?
Yes.
And so this is his life story in a radio version on The God Show. And let me assure you, you've only heard a tiny part of it now, because Topeka was really kind of just the beginning. And by the way, you are a guy that not only do I feel this way in short acquaintance, but people that have known you, that I've known, have told me about you, and they've all done their descriptions with a remarkable degree of admiration. They really have been impressed with you. And so the value system must have been planted there somewhere. I'm not talking about your adult value system or the value system later on behind bars. I'm talking about somebody at some point in your childhood or your adolescence, somebody must have planted at least the ideas of positive values. Who would that have been?
That would have been Dave Alvarado. He was my CASA worker, or court-appointed special advocate. At about, I want to say it was junior high, maybe a little bit later, as I was being tossed around from group home to group home, they would get more severe. They would be higher level 5, level 6, so more violent offenders at these places and just more violence involved. Well, Dave is the kind of worker, you know, his position with CASA is they're volunteer. They come in, they see the court, and they see the placements and why you've been tossed around so much, and they try to fix it. So Dave starts sending me mail of just, you know, really generic, superficial, blonde jokes. And at that time, I was a pretty angry kid. I'd been through a lot of stuff and really wasn't trying to meet anyone else that worked for the state that was supposedly on my side or my friend. And that's what I took Dave as at the beginning, was just another state worker.
And you'd been let down before.
Quite a bit. You know, I didn't trust anyone. I'd lived in foster homes where the father was a reverend Methodist reverend at our church. And then he was arrested 6 months into me living there for molesting children. They found porno in his top drawer when the police came in and raided him. And because my foster brother and I were the ones who blew the whistle on him, they put us in lockup. They didn't even take his license. So we were the bad kids because we were the ones already in the system. It definitely puts that bad taste in your mouth of trust. There was no trust whatsoever. So
but Dave, there was Dave, though.
And he worked so hard at that. He would send me letters even when I wouldn't answer them. He would call me when I would ignore him. He pushed and pushed and pushed. And finally one day, he showed up at one of my football games and he was videoing. He videoed the entire game. He wrote down all the stats. He was just a friend. He was what every parent, uncle, scout, brother should have been in my life and wasn't. And Dave just he never let me down. And the time that they finally I was turning into an adult. I was being taken from one of the group homes. No one knew I was being moved. And just one day I was arrested and replaced. Dave showed up and Dave put his hand on my lap, on my leg. And he held my hand and he said, I'm never going to let you down. I'm never going to turn my back on you.
Did he?
He never did. He was always that guy. I thought he did when I was 19, once I had made it through the system. And I was using drugs and drinking. I was just very depressed and I didn't know what my purpose was. So Dave asked me to live with him. Dave and I were staying together. I got a job working night crew at Walgreens, and I was just not doing what I was supposed to do. I was using LSD and mescaline and just anything I could do to numb it. The last 18 years is all I wanted. And one day Dave came home on Christmas Eve. I had quit my job. I was frying on acid, and I laid underneath the Christmas tree staring at what I thought to be chipmunks crawling through the tree. And Dave walked in and he was so frustrated. He was just like, you know what, Chris, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to send you to Arizona. You're going to go out where your stepdad's at and you're gone. I need you to go get your stuff together and get this right, or you and I are done. And I literally took a plane ticket from Dave. I moved to Arizona, and 3 months later, I was raided for a joint in my dorm room playing college baseball. And Dave was the guy who flew out to bail me out of jail.
Now, with all of that, because that's almost an Oz-like jump. So I was doing all of this pharmaceutical jungle that I was living in, and I was experiencing all of the medication that would numb the pain of all of these experiences that I'd had with people that let me down. And then I wound up in Arizona going to college? Where?
Yeah, I came out to Arizona with my stepdad to go to play baseball at Yavapai. The original plan was to come out, be back with my stepdad, see if our relationship was going to be cordial
which
at
stepdad
best. The first one. His name's Max. He is the father of my brother Matthew and my sister Misty. He is the one I know as Dad. He's the one I call Dad. They separated in the mid-80s when they just couldn't get their stuff together. So I went out to Arizona to be with Max and my sister, who was getting into drugs. The goal was to try to help her get away while I'm getting away. Maybe we could help each other. And it was a mess from the gate. When I landed in Arizona, my dad and his wife are drinkers. They're heavy drinkers. They drink a lot. And that was the end of our beginning. There was just no way we were going to make it work with the drinking.
You had just come from a booze household.
I did. And I tried to explain that. But, you know, my household was one of those of do as I say, not as I do. I'm going to do what I do. You're not supposed to watch or call me on it. You just do what you do. So I ended up leaving. I moved out and slept on the floor of a kitchen of a friend of mine's apartment just because I knew I would be away from the drinking, away from the fighting, and I could at least go to work, take care of me.
Were you in school at the time?
I wasn't in school yet. At this time, I was just working and working out, trying to make the team on a walk-on tryout basis. So I spent a year working out with a gentleman named Ken Brock. He played for the Cardinals in the minor leagues for 9 years. The girlfriend that I had at the time, her parents were really big in the community. They owned real estate. They owned a real estate company. They introduced me to Ken. They said, look, Ken can get you where you need to go to get in front of a baseball scout. So I spent that time, I really dedicated my time trying to be devoted to baseball. But at the time with my sister's drug use, it was just a tough go. I was working out, but at the end of my workout, I'm going to save my sister from this drug-induced relationship that she was in with some almost 30-year-old guy, and she's only 16. So it just, you know, my focus was supposed to be on school, but as the violence got worse with my sister, I had to step in.
Okay, so you were still, though, capable of carrying college curriculum, so you must have been a pretty good student at the time, in spite of all of the social problems and the background and all that you had faced in Kansas and then later in Arizona. You were still accepted by Yavapai. Yeah. Not just to play baseball, but you still had to go to class.
Right. Yeah, I walked on. I had a chance to come on in January in the early 90s and do a walk-on tryout, just see where you're at. I threw 8 pitches and made the team. I really didn't think that was even a possibility. I mean, the fact that I could throw a ball is the only reason I survived 20 years. But I didn't think that it was good enough to even get me on a college program. It did. And I tried to take advantage of that. I moved up here in the second semester in Prescott to play ball, and I made it about 3 months and got in trouble for cannabis.
Okay. Were you ever completely drug-free during that period of time?
When I worked out for my tryout, everything but cannabis. And when I grew up, you know, growing up, even with the violence and the trouble, pot in my family was normal. My parents grew it. My mom made lotions and salves out of it. We never knew it was quote unquote bad. I mean, we knew you'd get arrested and go and get in trouble, but we also knew you didn't get sick. It was something that kept us healthy. So when I moved to Arizona, we felt like, you know, I'm going to a way more liberal area. They're going to understand a lot more about this stuff. I had no idea that 3 months after being in Prescott that I was going to be looking at prison.
But you weren't healthy. You were diagnosed at some point with Crohn's disease.
Yes. 2007, I was diagnosed with Crohn's. Growing up in group homes, I'd always been told, oh, it's an ulcer or, you know, diverticulitis, IC problems.
You had had symptoms during that period of time.
I found out in 2007 it was Crohn's, and that's when I made the connection that my cannabis use this whole time was actually treating my Crohn's. I just didn't put the two and two together until I got diagnosed and actually got to start reading and studying.
That is a problem with the digestive system,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And you had unknowingly had it for how long?
Well, it sounds like all my life. I'd had it all my life and just been misdiagnosed with other problems.
It's painful.
Very painful. It's like I compare it to food poisoning meets the flu.
Well, that's about as descriptive, I think, as you're going to find outside of any major medical program.
Right.
Forget Mayo's. You just heard about Crohn's disease, at least as Chris Martin experienced it. So medical marijuana, that came into existence under the law in Arizona when?
2010.
And you know it to the year.
I do. I was one of the first patients to get his card. I was in line with bells on.
Okay. Now, were you in line just because you wanted to get high or because it helped you with the Crohn's disease?
I didn't want to go to jail for a medicine that made me feel better, especially when I'd already been to jail for a plant.
Talk about that experience, getting busted.
You know, the first time I got busted, I played college baseball. I had a joint in my top drawer in my dorm room. My roommate at the time was a drinker. He had drank a couple drinks that night, got a little loud. Campus police was called. They came to check us, make sure we were okay, walked in the room, saw he was drunk, started to search the room, found a joint. I was arrested for a dangerous drug in a drug-free school zone. I was eventually sentenced to 3 years in DOC.
What year was this? You were
1995.
Arrested? Okay.
They said because I had grown up in the system in Kansas that I had obviously liked that. So the judge felt compelled to send me back. He sent me to prison for 3 years and banned me from college for 2 years afterwards.
So what facility?
I landed the first time I went to prison. Let's see, I went to Perryville. I went to Marana. I was the first 24 inmate off of the bus in Buckeye when they opened Buckeye. I was in Douglas.
You could write a tour book, even if you didn't write one about your life. You could do a tour book just simply about the incarceration facilities of Arizona.
That book actually comes out the end of the year. It's called Prison for Profit Through the Eyes of an Inmate.
Oh, so you are? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that one will be published the end of the year.
Well, listen, you're welcome for the promo.
Thank you.
Glad you got a plug. an early commercial for the book.
I appreciate it.
Okay, so there you are, a kid that is incarcerated. First time at what age?
I was 19 years old.
And you're in prison?
I was in prison.
With a lot of people who are older than 19 years old.
And bigger and meaner.
Yeah. Was it as bad as you thought it was going to be?
You know, I hate to say it, but the child system is way worse. Because
Explain that.
Well, you know, as an adult, you actually fear consequence for the most part. Most of us don't want to get more time. Most of us don't want to do anything that's going to cause us to stay there longer. As a child, you don't have that fear. You don't have that repercussion. You don't have that fear of, you know, what if I do something wrong? Because you're a kid, and you're pretty much you're treated that way. You know, for me, it guided me. It gave me rules. It gave me a standard to understand how the system works, how the bureaucracy is in lockup. So it kind of seasoned me for it. Unfortunately, I did well in that setting only because of my childhood.
Did you also get high?
No, I did not. I did smoke weed, absolutely. I smoked pot any chance I got because
in prison.
Absolutely.
Because there are still some folks, Chris, who think that once you get behind bars, that none of those things are available.
I wish that was the case. The problem is that The system knows it works. The system knows that those drugs are there. I mean, think about it. If recidivism worked, why are we building more prisons? If helping people go by going to prison to become drug-free is really working, then why are we still filling these prisons with minimum mandatory sentences? Makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever. I like to explain it like this. I had the luxury of going to prison two different time frames, two different decades. And I say luxury because I get to explain to people now where we've gone wrong and what we're doing wrong. When I went to prison the first time, you got a key to your own room. There were college classes. There were rehabilitative programs. There were things that guaranteed your success. And granted, it's up to you to use them, of course. While we know prison's a necessary evil, 90% of those men and women want to come home and they want to do better and they don't want to get caught. So when you go to a system that has those kinds of programs, 90% of you are going to do better. You're going to come home and not go back, and that's what we want.
And what was the location for that system?
That system was Arizona. It was definitely all over. Douglas, Perryville, Buckeye, all those prisons. Okay. But now when I went back to prison, you know, there is no more your own room. There is no more keys to your own privacy.
Where?
In same prisons. Where now they've not only, they've taken like Home Depot style buildings and they've turned them into prisons. Now in Buckeye, they have what they're called dorms. So you have 300 people that live in the same building fighting over six toilets. And they are supposed to be promoting positive change and being able to focus on you and come home. It just doesn't work that way. The classes don't exist. The rehabilitation's not there anymore. You walk into a class, you sign your name, and they excuse you. They tell you, thank you, we got your signature, because they get paid for that. They don't get paid for the fact that you actually learned something in that class and go home a better human. They get paid because you supposedly showed up and signed that you were there.
These are the profit prisons.
Yes, these are the private. Well, actually, they're all profit. I mean, what people don't understand, and that's what my book talks about, is they're all for profit. There's nothing. I mean, the only thing private in these prisons are the contracts that they have on the phone systems or the commissary systems. Or if you can go buy stock in a prison and gain a profit, how is anything about that private? Nothing about it's private. Prisons were restructured as real estate investment trusts in 2013, which means you, me, and the guy next to me can go invest. We can go drop $1,000 and at the end of the year receive an income. I don't understand how that's not a crime against humanity, how a federal lawsuit should not be filed against the people that make those profits.
I can't invest in Florence, though.
Yes, you can. Absolutely. You could go invest into, it's now, what is it? It's, they've changed their name. It was, I believe it's Core Civic or Civic Core now. They used to be CCA. They just keep changing their names because they changed the ticker name. Absolutely, you can go invest your money, and that should scare a lot of people.
So when you went back into that prison system, did you, after a short period of time, feel that it was all too familiar, that once again you were thrust into a situation in which nobody gave a damn about you, just like the situation that you grew up in?
Absolutely, and that's where meeting Jim, kind of my second Dave in county, kind of gave me the notion of what my message was. When I met Jim and kind of felt that he was a prophet, I guess, a man bringing God into my life at the time, it opened up so many doors on what my message really was, on what these 40 years was all about. You know, I thought my time was in vain.
So who's Jim?
Jim Wassel was an inmate. Jim was a guy. When I went into jail on this last time for my edible company, I had lost everything.
Back up. Why did they bust you?
I got busted. I started an edible company after I was diagnosed.
Explain to everybody what that means.
Yeah, after I was diagnosed in 2007 with Crohn's, cannabis was legalized medically in Arizona in 2010. My wife and I both became caregiver growers, which allowed us the right to grow 12 plants each. But what it doesn't allow us to do is to harvest those plants and hold the product. So when you have a medical card, you're allowed 2.5 ounces of finished flower. But if you're allowed to grow 12 plants, I mean, I can grow 12 pounds. So what do I do with the access? The access is really what got us in trouble. So we didn't want to turn into drug dealers and sell pot to everybody. So I made an edible company called Zonka, which is, I'm known as Billy Zonka, the Willy Wonka of chocolate. So I started a candy edible company. Literally, I was smoking a joint, sitting around a table just like this, and I tore open a sweet tart package, and the W turned into a Z.
The Candyman can.
Ta-da. And the next day, I was at Michael's buying molds, and we were making suckers and candy bars and donating them. It was the quickest way I could find to get rid of the flour, get rid of the product without selling it, making a bunch of money and going to prison for it. So we donated to compassion clubs, collectives, anywhere I could get it to patients. People had cards, but nowhere to go buy medicine. We had 3 years that it was legal in this state and nowhere to get medicine. So we felt like this was our opportunity to get the medicine to people. The police department in the state felt they had a different opinion. They had a different plan for us. They raided us, stating that I was actually manufacturing a narcotic.
Did anybody turn you in?
Oh, yeah. My ex-wife is an amazing woman. She not only didn't want to be with me, she wanted to be with half my friends. So instead of divorcing me at the time, she went on with them, so I divorced her. After the divorce, she went and got a job at the county attorney's office as a lead legal secretary after having zero experience. And a year later, I was raided. I mean, coincidence, I think not. If I could prove it, we'd be in court right now. I can prove that 60 days after the day of my raid, she was awarded an award by Sheila Polk, the attorney, the DA in Yavapai County, for her help in criminal investigations. So as a legal secretary, I'm not sure how she connected the dots in a legal, you know, criminal investigation other than being my ex-wife. So
highly skilled woman.
Absolutely.
So there you were, as the sweets dealer.
Yep. Munchie Syndicate, as it was known in Prescott.
Oh, that's Munchie Syndicate.
We were the Munchie Syndicate.
Great, great name. And
I wear it like a badge of honor.
And there are people right now who are listening, not only across the country, but in different parts of the world, who are saying, well, in our place, it isn't, medical marijuana isn't legal yet. And so you mean that you can make candy and you can make confections and all of these things? There's virtually no end to the stuff,
right,
that cannabis can be used as an ingredient in.
Absolutely. That's kind of our take on it. It's a phytonutrient. It's a food product. It's something that's been on this planet a lot longer than any of us.
Is there anything wrong with it?
Not in my opinion. What's the only thing that's wrong with it is if you get caught. Don't get caught with it. To me, that's the biggest fear of the planet.
Science is still investigating, even though times have changed dramatically.
Right.
Canada has legalized it. Looks like Mexico probably will.
Right.
And I'd say that the percentage is pretty strong that at least most of the states in the USA will probably find reason to legalize it recreationally.
Absolutely.
But certainly medically. However, the research still goes on about the psychotic effects, personality changes, that kind of thing. Do you acknowledge the fact that there are things that we don't know about pot?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you're not allowed to study something because the lack of a patent or the lack of money, how could we know about it? I definitely am all for learning and studying and learning more about this plant and sharing with people. But where my problem is when the government's owned the patent on cannabis since the 60s as a neuroprotectant, you can't throw people in jail for it later when you know that it helps them. It, to me, you're serving two masters, and it's just not fair. It's the side of the page that most of us don't get to see unless you get raided, unless you get thrown in jail because of this plant. It doesn't affect you. It doesn't matter to you. And that's where I think this story needs to be told, because we're all affected by this. If we go buy Colgate and use it to brush our teeth, Colgate's invested into private prisons, but nobody knows that.
They Snapple, do now.
They do now. Snapple, same thing. Nobody knows those things unless you research it. And why would you research it unless you're not involved? To me, I think we all should research it, because most of us have a retirement. Most of us invest that money into a retirement program. But did anyone know that most of the largest investment programs are the ones who run all that stock? I mean, we should really think about it.
You know? California did, didn't they?
They did.
And a few other states. However, there's another part of the story here that remains only partially told, and that is the chapter in Chris Martin's life called Jim. Pursue that.
You know, Jim was, at the time being, I felt like he was the Dave of that time period.
What was he in for?
Jim was actually in for drugs. Jim was in a prison already in Yuma for drugs. He was on a page two, which means they found new charges. They flew him from Yuma in a plane up to Prescott, Camp Verde Jail, for his new charges. When we met, because of my demeanor and what I do in the jail, I mean, I've been in so many times and so long, it's my place. Like, I introduce myself to everyone. I make sure they need food or they need a razor. I'm that guy. So when I met Jim, as soon as I shook Jim's hand, you just got that feeling of good person. Like, you don't feel those things in county jail of all places. You definitely don't meet friends there. But Jim was different. Jim and I spoke quite a bit, you know, in the first 5 or 10 minutes, but very superficial, very generic. He came up to me after the 10-minute little meeting we had, and he said, you know, I wrote a letter last night on my flight to Camp Verde. In that dream, God came to me and asked me to give you a note. And I didn't know it was for you, but after we spent 10 minutes, now I know it's for you. And me, being the president of a three-piece club and growing up in 40 group homes and foster homes, God and I hadn't been very close. I just felt like he kind of ignored me. And my joke, honestly, growing up was God hates me. Like, I felt like God hated me. I felt like he walked behind me and flicked me just to laugh. And I felt like that because of what I had seen and grown up with. And when Jim came in up to me and said, hey, look, I want you to read this, and I opened it, and it said prophecy across the top, all I could do was laugh. I'm in county jail. I'm the president of a 1% club, and I got some dude who's a prophet now telling me about God. So I immediately just kind of walked away, like, what am I doing? And I had to take minutes for me. Jim came up and said, look, Chris, I'm new to this. I'm new to my walk. I've only been doing this for 7 months, so I'm sure it's as crazy to you as it is to me. But I want you to listen. He told me to read this to you. Even if you don't want me to read it, take it.
Do you think it was a wacko?
Absolutely. I'm in county jail. I mean, I've done so much time in jail that usually those are the people that have either touched kids or beat women, or they run and grab the Bible and hide behind it. And I don't mean that negatively, because there's lots of good people in there that follow Christ. It's just that's the typical story in prison is, you know, oh, he's only hiding behind the Bible because of his charges or whatever. So, yeah, of course, with my background, that's exactly what I thought. Once he opened up the paper and I saw the prophecy, the first verse on it was Isaiah 38:40. He who turns his eyes to God will fly on the wings of eagles. And the only reason it affected me so much was because I was the president of the Desert Eagles. And I have a huge tattoo on my arm to show the patch of my club, which he couldn't see. So it's not like he made it up as we went. Well, he saw the chills on my arm, like I have right now, and he said, that's confirmation. I want you to know that's you being confirmed. You're supposed to be here doing this right now. And I'm laughing like, you're crazy, man. No, it's cold in jail. You know, they keep it cold in here. It's like a hospital. He opens it up, or as he opens up the page and says, just read the second verse, I read it, and it's Jeremiah 29:11, about him knowing his plan for you even when you don't know that plan. And the verse didn't mean much to me at the time, but the numbers did, because I was married on 11-11-11. My football number is 11. My baseball number is 11. I look at the clock twice a day at 11:11 and 2:22. Those two numbers have always meant something to me, and I've never understood why, ever, 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 until Jim. Jim and I spent some time just kind of, you know, generically getting to know each other. Then he hands me the book, and that's where it all happened. He says, look, if this book means nothing to you, then you take it and you throw it away. You beat me up. You do whatever it is that makes you feel better. So I take the book. I sit in my cell. And I'm literally, like, this is a standoff with this book. I put it on my bunk. I'm sitting on the toilet looking at the ceiling going, what am I doing? What am I doing? All these people out here that count on me to run this dorm are going to see me walk out with a Bible, and they're going to think I either committed the worst felony known to man or I've just lost it. This is not good for my future, because I've got to do time now. So I grab the book. I flip it open. I point, and sure enough, Isaiah 38:40. And I've never opened the book, so I couldn't tell you where Isaiah is at that point. I put the book back down. And I just kind of look at it, shake my head. I pick it back up. I point again. It's Jeremiah 29:11. Now I've thrown this book across the cell. I got snot bubbles and tears and everything just coming out of my face. Like, what is happening? I don't even understand the feelings that I'm having. So Jim walks in and he's got this look on his face, like almost like I told you so, but not being condescending, you know? So I told him what happened. And at that point, he just put his hand on my shoulder and he prayed. And he prayed and he prayed. He spoke in tongues. And he did all this weird stuff that I didn't know anything about. And literally, I just froze. The next morning, I woke up with this draw in my chest, this pull of, I want to know more. I need to know more. So I spent the next 8 days with Jim just learning. Learned the book, Bible study, everything I could do just to learn and figure out why I'm here. Each day, two or three more guys joined the Bible study. To where the final day, there was only one person left in that jail cell that did not join our Bible study. There's about 30 people that joined it. Jim looked at me and said, Chris, you understand that you're a leader of men. It's time for you to lead in a new direction. And I froze and I laughed like, Jim, I'm not a preacher. If you're telling me I'm supposed to leave jail and go preach to people, you got the wrong guy. This is not my job. That's not it. And he goes, no, I don't know what I'm telling you. I just know there's something bigger here. And when it's bigger than you, you need to give it to him. When it's bigger than you, give it up. And I'm lost. I feel like I'm being spoke to in another language. So the next day, Jim comes to me. It's the date of my court hearing for my bond hearing. And he says, look, Chris, I prayed for you last night and God told me you're going home. I was so worked up with emotion that I grabbed this guy and I slammed him against the wall and I held him up against the wall and said, I don't think you understand who you're messing with. If I come back from jail and I didn't get my bond lowered and all this hokey pokey Bible stuff is not true, you're not going to want to live here anymore. I'm going to suggest you relocate. And the weirdest thing happened. For the first time in 40 years of being physical with another man, he never once swung at me. He didn't even look at me like he was angry or pissed off. He literally just looked at me like, you know, I'm just sharing the word. Do what you have to do. And literally, I was so humbled. I'm fixing his shirt. I'm straightening his clothing out. Like, I'm so sorry, Jim. You didn't deserve that. I'm so overwhelmed with emotion. I haven't seen my family. I'm sick with Crohn's. I have no meds. Everything's bad. It's a bad country song. Everything is really bad. And he says, Chris, you're still going to go home tomorrow. So I felt like I owed it to him. Like, tell me, teach me why, tell me how to pray, tell me whatever it is I need to do going into battle. So we spent that whole night. I did not sleep. I went over numbers, synchronicity, praying, the whole jazz. They walked me over to the cell to the holding cell the next day for my court hearing. And all I hear is, Jim, when it's bigger than you, give it to him. Still don't know what it means. They walked me into court. My club's there. My wife's there. Everyone's there. And it's just this emotional hurricane. It's so many things happening at once. The state's arguing with the judge about taking my kids, and all I can hear is, Jim, give it to him, man. It's bigger than you. I grabbed my belly chains. I looked at the lights that I'm standing under. It's like I'm on stage at a concert, and I prayed. I said, you know what? If you're real, I don't think you understand what a loyal person I am, which of course he understands. But at the time, I just wanted to make him aware. Like, I am so devout. I'll share the world with this message. And before I could say amen, they lowered my bond to 50 grand. The club ran out of the room. They were getting my bond together and get me out of there. So by the time I got back to the cell, Jim was standing there just with this look like, I already know, but please tell me. So I shared it with him. And immediately our message, you know, he came to me and said, look, now you see, now you understand what I told you was the truth. Involve your life into the truth. Involve your life into the church. And that's what we did. We got out. We got baptized. We poured our life into this church.
Who's we?
My wife, my kids. I actually left the club. I had guys leave the club with me and join the church. I had Hell's Angels leave the Hell's Angels and join the church.
But why at some point, just as a human being, with all of your strength, there are still weaknesses in all of us, why is it at some point, didn't you say, Jesus Christ? No, I'm not cursing. I'm saying, Jesus Christ, I'm calling on you to explain to me why you put me through all that crap growing up, leading up to this moment of revelation.
I was still so new in my walk, I didn't know what to do. I was still trying to figure all this out. And from my understanding, it's not his fault. So why can I blame him for what I walked, for what I went through? It's not on him. And I didn't learn that until Jim showed me. And when the numbers thing happened, we were kicked out of our church about 7 months into this walk because I used cannabis. I was the chef at the church. My wife was the janitor. My kids ran YF. We literally gave our word to God and to Jim, and we poured our lives into this church. The elders came to me and said, look, we know about your court case. We know about your hearing. We know that you're looking at prison. We know. We accept you. But you use cannabis. That's not a welcome sacrament in our church. And literally, after losing my club, my business, my future, my freedom, I never thought I'd lose my God. I never thought I would lose my church. Now I got to go home and tell my kids this. I have to go home and tell my children, look, you, after everything you've witnessed and been a part of, you can no longer go to this church and pray. So I'm sitting at home. The first and only time I've ever considered suicide in my entire life. I'm about to go to prison for gosh knows how long. I've just lost my church. I've lost everything. My wife went back to work. My kids are in school. And I'm sitting at home in tears. I'm literally screaming at the ceiling like, I gave you my word. I did everything you asked me to do. I followed it. What did I do wrong? And I slammed my hand down on my laptop while I was working. And this computer screen pops up. And it's just an advertisement. It's a split screen. And on half of it, it was a 222 Sirius radio station advertisement. And that radio station was owned by a friend of mine, Shannon, that I went to college with. So just the synchronicity. Boom, I see the twos, and right away I got the chills, and I'm like, man, what do those twos mean? I don't know what that means. And on the other half of the ad was Calvary Church and a verse, Revelations 22:2. So at this point, I'm still so new in my walk, I don't know what I'm doing, but I know Revelations is in the end, and I know where to find it in the book. So I flip it open, Revelations 22:2, and I read it. And the verse said, I give to you seed-bearing plants to heal all nations. I had chills, I had snot bubbles, I had tears. He answered me again. He told me, you're doing my work. You're doing what you're supposed to do. You might get ridiculed. You might end up in jail. You might end up in trouble, but you're still doing what I'm asking you to do by helping teach, helping bring people to this medicine and to this plant.
And are you now currently, besides having the book, having a documentary coming out, are you professionally in the cannabis business?
I am. I own a few businesses. I own an edible company, Zonka, which I got to relaunch after the raid with a 12,000 square foot grow and a license. I'm working with a public company, American Green, that's helped me do that. We started the hemp company out of necessity. I was fighting, you know, staying relevant after this raid. So when I went to hemp, it was more out of necessity and paying the bills and feeding my family. I didn't really understand the medical side of hemp because the lack of education. So once I got to play and study and research, and I realized that how close and family they are and what they can do for you as a whole, all bets were off.
I'm going to ask you now a tough question, not tough for me to ask, but maybe tough for you to answer. After all that you've experienced, do you think you would be as spiritual a person as you turned out to be without pot?
It's a great question. I mean, I really don't know about that. I don't know if I would have been.
There are many people, particularly when we reflect on the 60s and that period of time when religious people were chanting and singing and discovering new levels of deities, right? Different deities, right? And so much of it had to do with ganja. Yep. And so you're saying to me right now, though, that there is a possibility that that was a part of it.
I agree that it was. Absolutely. I think it's part of the story, the message, and exactly why we're all on this planet.
We got about a minute and a half left, and I've got about 785 other questions to ask you. So I think maybe you're going to be one of the few guests that we invite back.
Yes.
For part two.
Contagious.
For part two of Chris Martin's story, because it continues. What does staying clean mean to you now?
You know, it's my priority. It's my life. That's why I started my nonprofit, ZonkaMiles.org, where we help inmates that have drug problems but are coming home on parole or probation and have no resources, or kids like me that are 17 turning 18 and have no family and no resources to come home to. So we started that nonprofit for those people to stay clean, just like us.
You're a happy guy, but do you believe that your happiness can also include forgiveness for a system that did what it did to you then? Do you believe there's justice in America?
I believe there's just us in America. I think we're working on the justice side. Until we can remove corporate greed out of the justice system, we're going to continue down the same path.
I think you may want to know the title of the book. You don't want to wait for his second appearance? Okay, well, the story up to now is in One Life, the Chris Martin story. Is this available everywhere?
Right now, we have it available at our website, thechrismartinstory.com.
Why don't you tell everybody that website again?
Yeah, it's thechrismartinstory.com. We've got a pre-order for our cookbook. We have this book on there. We've got a bunch of stuff happening on there. We're working with a distribution company. So once that happens, we're hoping to have it on Amazon.
Be careful with some of those ingredients, by the way, in the cookbook, depending on where you live. Somewhere in the general area of those people whose lives are intertwined every so often with the God Show.